Saturday evening in the Vancouver Institute's Dr. Connor Cruz O'Brien, who I am sure is well known to many of you, will speak to us on the subject, the press and the world. The following week, October 31st, Professor Marketa Getz-Stankiewicz, the head of the Department of Germanic Studies at this university, will speak to us on the Czech theater. On November the 7th, Dr. Martin Hoffman, Faculty of Medicine, UBC, will speak to us on the subject, Understanding Diabetes, What Everyone Should Know. So as you can see from this indication of our immediately forthcoming lectures and further lectures to come, we have many, many exciting Saturday evenings in this term and the next term ahead of us. Let me also remind you of the availability of memberships. They are only $2 for a student, $10 for a single membership, and $15 for a family. This must be, without a doubt, one of the great bargains of 1981. These memberships will be available to you in the corridor, in the outside hall, as you leave. Some of you may feel, like many businesses in this time of inflation and imminent bankruptcy, that our prices might drop as we approach Christmas. That is not the case. Our prices are firm, they are low, but they will not be reduced anymore. There will be no Christmas sale. So I ask you to join now and experience that warm inner glow which comes from performing a good deed. In addition to that, there are certain perquisites attached to membership, one of which will be available to those who are members 2 weeks from tonight, when there will be a reception in the faculty club to which all members are invited after the talk of Dr. Marketa Getz-Stankiewicz. Well, as you recognize, we have an overflow crowd this evening, which indicates that the combination of such a subject as life in the universe and such a lecturer as Professor Freeman Dyson is a very popular combination. After the address, I will take Professor Dyson to the other room so that the individuals in the other audience can see him in the flesh and can have the opportunity to ask him one or two questions. Then he will be brought back here for additional questions and to be thanked. It gives me great pleasure to draw to your attention the many achievements of Professor Dyson and to briefly indicate his background. He was born in England in 1923. He received his Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics from the University of Cambridge in 1945. He went to Cornell University in 1947 with a Commonwealth Fellowship and became a professor of physics at that university in 1951. Since 1953, he has been a professor of physics at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He helped to design the Trigger reactor and the Orion spaceship at General Atomic in San Diego from the years 1956 to 1959. He has many, many honors. He was awarded the Danny Heinemann Prize by the American Institute of Physics in 1965. And recently, he was awarded the Harvey Prize by the Technion Haifa Israel in 1977. In between, he has received the Max Planck Medal, the J. Robert Oppenheimer Memorial Prize, the Hughes Medal of the Royal Society, and others. So this is no ordinary individual we have coming to speak to you. In fact, in trying to compose an eloquent introduction, I've found that I could really do no better than to read from the program. One of the world's great thinkers, Freeman Dyson, physicist, mathematician, and astronomer, has ranged widely from the deepest problems of science and society to future space travel and practical problems of current energy alternatives. The imaginative ideas, incisive thinking, and elegant language expressed in his books and many contributions to the New Yorker magazine have gained Professor Dyson a following perhaps more distinguished than that of any other scientist writing today. It gives me great pleasure to ask Professor Dyson to address us.
So thank you very much for your kind words, and thank you for inviting me here. Sorry I can't greet all my friends personally, but I hope at least I'll see a few of you afterwards. And I hope we'll have some conversation, some questions when I'm done here. So life in the universe is too vague and pretentious a theme for a one-hour lecture, so I'll begin by narrowing it down. I shall be talking mainly about the history of science, describing how scientists at various times have dealt with the awkward mismatch between the behavior of living things on the one hand and the behavior of the non-living universe on the other. At the end, I shall indulge in some speculations about the future, describing possible ways in which the sciences of life and non-life may be made to fit together. But the future of science is always unpredictable. So anything I say about the future is intended to be fantasy, not prediction. To remind us of the fallibility of human judgment, I tell you first about my earliest encounter with Francis Crick. Crick is the hero of my story in some sense. Crick, the discoverer with Watson of the double helix and elucidator of the structure of the genetic code. The encounter occurred in 1945 in Feynham House, a dismal office building in London, where the Royal Navy kept a staff of scientists working on technical problems connected with the war. Crick had been working for the Navy for a long time and was depressed and discouraged. He said he had missed his chance of ever amounting to anything as a scientist. The war had hit him at the worst possible time, putting a stop to his career as a physicist and keeping him away from real science for 6 years. The six best years of his life squandered on naval intelligence, lost and gone forever. Crick was good at naval intelligence and did important work. But military intelligence, we are told, bears the same relation to intelligence as military music bears to music. So after 6 years in this kind of intelligence, it was far too late for Crick to start all over again as a student and learn all the stuff he had forgotten. No wonder he was discouraged. In his discouragement, he said he was thinking of giving up physics and trying to make a completely fresh start as a biologist. But that looked equally hopeless. After you've been out of things for 6 years, there's not much chance you'll ever be able to catch up. I came away from Feynham House thinking, how sad, such a bright chap. If it hadn't been for the war, he'd have probably been quite a good scientist. I tell this story about Crick because it raises some interesting questions. Is it ever too late to catch up with science? Is it really a disaster, or is it a blessing in disguise when academic careers are disrupted and people are forced to find their own paths to intellectual survival? How did it happen that Crick emerged from his despair and did so spectacularly well as a biologist? I won't answer these questions. I'll only say that there are other examples besides the career of Crick, which convince me that a rigid system of courses and qualifying exams is not a good way to bring gifted people into science. It sometimes helps if the system is disrupted by a war or by a bit of social turmoil. It's customary to divide scientists into professional categories labeled by subject matter. So some of us are labeled as physicists and some as biologists. This system of labeling places additional obstacles in the path of young people who aim to cross the border between physics and biology, as Crick did 30 years ago. I think it may be illuminating to classify scientists in a different fashion, by their goals rather than by their disciplines. The major distinction I would make is between unifiers and diversifiers. Unifiers are people whose driving passion is to find general principles which will explain everything. They are happy if they can leave the universe looking a little simpler than they found it. Diversifiers are people whose passion is to explore the details. They are in love with the heterogeneity of nature, and they are happy if they leave the universe a little more complicated than they found it. It's generally true that the very greatest scientists in each discipline are the unifiers. This is especially true in physics. Newton and Einstein were supreme as unifiers. The great triumphs of physics have been triumphs of unification. We almost take it for granted that the road of progress in physics will be a wider and wider unification, bringing more and more phenomena within the scope of a few fundamental principles. Einstein was so confident of the correctness of this road of unification that at the end of his life he took almost no interest in the experimental discoveries which were then beginning to make the world of physics look more complicated. It is difficult to find among physicists any serious voices in opposition to unification. In biology, the roles are reversed. A very few of the greatest biologists are unifiers. Darwin was a unifier, consciously seeing himself as achieving for biology the unification which Newton had achieved for physics. Darwin succeeded in encompassing the entire organic world within his theory of evolution. But the organic world remains fundamentally and irremediably diverse. Diversity is the essence of life, and the essential achievement of Darwin was to give intellectual coherence to that diversity. Biology is the natural domain of diversifiers, as physics is the domain of unifiers. Among biologists of the present day, we can still find a few unifiers, and one of the most successful is Francis Crick. 12 years after our meeting at Feynman House, Crick propounded and named the central dogma of molecular biology. So I quote his definition. The central dogma. This states that once information has passed into protein, it cannot get out again. The propounding of dogmas is an unusual activity for a biologist. Even Crick does not spend much of his time propounding dogmas. He spends most of his time studying the details of structures, just as Darwin spent much of his time studying the details of the taxonomy of barnacles. But at heart, Crick is a unifier, and in the end, he will be remembered as the man who stated in simple words the unifying principle of biology for the 20th century, as Darwin did for the 19th. So let me pull together the threads of the argument so far. I'm saying every science needs for its healthy growth a creative balance between unifiers and diversifiers. In the physics of the last 100 years, the unifiers had things too much their own way. Diversifiers in physics, such as John Wheeler in our own time, have tended to be pushed out of the mainstream. John Wheeler holds uncompromisingly to his diversifier's view of the physical universe. Here is John Wheeler in his recent book, Frontiers of Time. So I quote from Wheeler, individual events, events beyond law, events so numerous and so uncoordinated that flaunting their freedom from formula, they yet fabricate firm form. It sounds like Beowulf, but it is authentic Wheeler. This vision of nature is regarded by the orthodox physicists as belonging to poetry rather than to science. Wheeler's colleagues love him more than they listen to him. The physics of the unifiers has no room for his subversive thoughts. In biology, there's been a healthier balance. The mainstream of biology is the domain of the diversifiers, the domain of events numerous and uncoordinated, flaunting their freedom from formula. But when a unifier like Darwin or Crick arrives on the scene, he is not ignored. He is even after a while honored and rewarded, and his ideas flow into the mainstream. So I'm suggesting there may come a time when physics will be willing to learn from biology as biology has been willing to learn from physics, a time when physics will accept the endless diversity of nature as one of its central themes, just as biology has accepted the unity of the genetic coding apparatus as one of its central dogmas. In earlier centuries, there was no clear separation between the sciences of cosmology and biology. Even the most austere and respectable physicists conceived of the heavenly universe as filled with living creatures. Christian Huygens, the originator of the wave theory of light and a physicist of impeccable credentials, wrote a book on cosmology with the title Cosmotheoros in 1698. And I quote, "A man that is of Copernicus's opinion that this earth of ours is a planet, carried round and enlightened by the sun, like the rest of the planets, cannot but sometimes think that it's not improbable that the rest of the planets have their dress and furniture, and perhaps their inhabitants too, as well as this earth of ours." His great contemporary Isaac Newton carried such thoughts even further. Now I quote from Newton. I need to take a deep breath. "As all regions below are replenished with living creatures, not only the earth with beasts and the sea with fishes and the air with fowls and insects, but also standing waters, vinegar, the bodies and blood of animals and other juices with innumerable living creatures too small to be seen without the help of magnifying glasses, so may the heavens above be replenished with beings whose nature we do not understand. He that shall well consider the strange and wonderful nature of life and the frame of animals will think nothing beyond the possibility of nature, nothing too hard for the omnipotent power of God. And as the planets remain in their orbs, so may any other bodies subsist at any distance from the earth. And much more may beings who have a sufficient power of self-motion move whether they will, place themselves where they will, and continue in any regions of the heavens whatever, there to enjoy the society of one another, and by their messengers or angels to rule the earth and converse with the remotest regions." I quote this passage from a recent book, The Religion of Isaac Newton, by Frank Manuel. He's a historian at Brandeis. Huygens and Newton belonged to the last generation of cosmologists who felt free to people the universe with creatures in this fashion. The style and the temper of science were already changing in a direction which would make such flights of fancy unacceptable. Neither Huygens nor Newton had the courage to expose their speculations to the ridicule of the public. Huygens arranged for his Cosmotheoros to be published after he was safely dead. Newton was even more timid and never published his private thoughts at all. But he was careful to preserve his manuscripts, and they can now, after 300 years, be found, still unpublished, in the library of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. The manuscripts stayed hidden from his contemporaries in a big black box, and the 18th century knew nothing of them. The 18th century dawned bleakly under a heaven grown empty and dead. Cosmology, ever since that time, has concerned itself only with an empty and dead universe. It is fruitless to speculate upon the might-have-beens of history. What might have been the effect on the cultural history of Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries if Newton had had the courage to publish his speculative cosmology? Judging from the state of the manuscript, which is a finished copy accompanied by several rough drafts, he had at one time intended to publish it. If he had done so, placing his unparalleled prestige as the supreme intellect of the Age of Enlightenment behind an unashamedly romantic and poetic view of the cosmos, would it have made any difference? Would European culture have avoided that whole disastrous split between the narrow rationalism of the Enlightenment, dominated by Newton's public image on the one hand, and the excessive irrationalism of the romantic reaction on the other? Could we have avoided the political manifestations of this split in Napoleonic centralism on the one hand and nationalistic frenzy on the other? Could we have avoided the conflict between science and religion, the conflict which soured the intellectual life of the 19th century and continues to impoverish Western culture even today. Obviously, it's unfair to hold Newton responsible for all these later misfortunes. It was not his fault that the universe beyond the Earth turned out to be dead and empty. When Newton decided to suppress his youthful visions of the cosmos, he was only doing what every good scientist is supposed to do, abandoning without mercy a beautiful theory which turned out to be unsupported by experimental facts. So we have been left since Newton's time with a cosmology in which living creatures play no part. Only a few heretics like John Wheeler dare to express the view that the structure of the heavens may not be unambiguously reducible to a problem in physics. Only a few romantics like me continue to hope that one day the links between biology and cosmology may be restored. What might we do now to start building bridges between biology and cosmology? There are at least two things we can do. The first thing is to look very hard at the universe and search for evidence of life and intelligence in remote places. If we are lucky, we might find that Newton gave up too easily his universe of celestial beings, that the cosmos is not really so dead and empty as it looks. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a continuing enterprise in which many respectable astronomers are intermittently engaged. Francis Crick has from the beginning taken this enterprise seriously and supported the efforts of the astronomers with his advice and encouragement. He is perhaps a little more optimistic than I am in his estimates of the chances of success. But the job of searching the universe for traces of life is a job for observers, not for theorists. There is little that theorists can do to help except to serve as fundraisers and cheerleaders. But there is a second way of building bridges between biology and cosmology, a way open to physicists and chemists rather than to astronomers. The second way is open, whether or not the universe turns out to be peopled with celestial friends and colleagues. The second way is to attempt a quantitative understanding of the potentialities of life in the universe. Francis Crick has been active here too. A few months ago, I received a letter from him saying, "I am still interested in the idea of directed panspermia. Our slogan was, bugs can go further." By this he means that there is every reason to expect spores to play an essential role in the propagation of life in the universe, just as they do in the propagation of life on Earth. Spores are the natural way to package biological and genetic information for rapid transit over interstellar distances. Panspermia is an old theory originally proposed by the chemist Svante Arrhenius about 70 years ago, or 80 years ago, rather. Arrhenius imagined the whole universe filled with the spores of life. Directed panspermia is panspermia plus intelligence, the universe filled with spores deliberately aimed toward habitats favorable to life's spread and survival. But if we're to understand in general terms the place of life in the universe, we must also understand life's origin. Darwin explicitly excluded the origin of life from the scope of his theory of evolution. In his earliest outline of the theory, drawn up in 1839 or soon thereafter, he wrote, "Extent of my theory, having nothing to do with first origin of life, growth, multiplication, mind, or with any attempt to find out whether it descended from one form and what that form was." He knew that only a massive and meticulous marshalling of evidence could make his theory convincing to his contemporaries. He had no hope of finding observational evidence relevant to the origin of life. and he therefore made no claim that the theory might throw light on the question of origins. Any such claim would expose a weak point in the structure of facts upon which his arguments rested. He could, and he did, discuss the origin of life privately among his friends. He could not discuss it publicly for fear of handing to his enemies the choice of battleground which he could not defend with factual evidence. So, like Newton, Darwin kept his more radical thoughts private and presented to the world a scientific edifice of grand design but limited scope. Hypotheses non fingo became his motto too. The effect of Darwin's caution was similar to the effect of Newton's. In both cases, a new science was created with clearly demarcated boundaries, and speculation transcending the boundaries was severely discouraged. The separation between biology and cosmology was reinforced by territorial boundaries on both sides. The question of the origin of life, which should have been a common meeting ground for the practitioners of both disciplines, became a no man's land accepted by neither. We are fortunate to be living at a time when the barriers are finally breaking down. The collapse of the barriers was celebrated 6 weeks ago at a meeting in King's College, Cambridge. The title of the meeting was Matter into Life, and the discussions were memorable, not for the number of problems solved, but for the number of problems unsolved. A huge territory now lies open, ranging from the crystallography of clay at one end to neurophysiology at the other. And over this whole area, there is a continuity of unsolved problems ready to sprout into new sciences. There is also a steady stream of pioneers infiltrating the territory from both ends. The central problem in understanding the origin of life is to explore in detail the possible molecular structures which might bridge the gap between the primeval soup and living cells. The job of exploring is primarily a job for experimental chemists. When physicists jump in and try to deduce the architecture of ancestral creatures from general theoretical principles, the usual result of their efforts is only to add one more unverifiable hypothesis to the already existing pile. Physicists can be useful if they confine themselves to a more modest role, asking questions which experimental chemists might be able to answer. Fortunately, the techniques of chemistry have now advanced to the point at which meaningful experiments investigating prebiotic evolution are becoming possible. We have seen evolution occurring in a population of non-living molecules in a test tube. There is a long way still to go, but the origin of life is now, after many years of unbridled speculation, finally emerging as a branch of experimental science. The main conclusion which I drew from the discussions at Cambridge at this Matter into Life meeting is that we should not try to force our descriptions of prebiotic evolution too rigidly into the Darwinian mold. There are two kinds of evolution, the Darwinian kind, driven by natural selection, and the non-Darwinian kind, driven by random genetic drift without selection. As soon as rudimentary living units are established, able to reproduce themselves with some degree of accuracy, Darwinian selection will pull them powerfully toward greater stability and more precise biochemical organization. But the decisive steps toward the origin of life must be taken at an earlier stage, when there are not yet any coherent self-reproducing units, when there is not yet a foothold for Darwinian selection to stand on. At this earlier stage, the pre-biological stage, we may imagine organic molecules in great variety subdivided into small isolated populations, either by sequestration in colloidal droplets or by adsorption onto solid particles. We have then an archipelago of small islands, each carrying its unique population of molecules, like the Galapagos Islands with their populations of Darwin's finches. Even in the absence of accurate reproduction and Darwinian selection, such an archipelago gives maximum opportunities for evolution by random drift. Whenever an island happens to accumulate a population of molecules with unusual catalytic properties, there will be an enhanced probability for further fluctuations leading to still more efficient catalysis. Once in a while, drifting uphill against the forces of disorganization, an island population may achieve a level of autocatalysis high enough to be self-sustaining. Only when that point is reached, when a closed cycle of self-sustained catalysis is momentarily established, Darwinian selection can begin to operate, and the island populations can begin to behave like living creatures, growing and dividing and competing for chemical raw materials. These are the bare bones of a theory of prebiotic evolution. It is now up to the chemists to put some flesh onto the bones. Progress in understanding the origin of life goes hand in hand with progress in understanding the structure of existing creatures, and progress in biochemistry goes hand in hand with progress in genetic engineering. Newton discarded his youthful dreams of a life-filled universe, but the time might come soon when we may be in a position to take matters into our own hands, to make Newton's dreams come true by our own efforts. Suppose that we find there are no spores traveling through space, either directed or undirected. Suppose that we fail to find traces of life anywhere outside our own planet. What would then be the minimum modifications that would have to be imposed upon terrestrial life to enable us to make good nature's lack? Now that genetic engineering is rapidly becoming a practical proposition, it is not at all absurd to think of redesigning terrestrial creatures so as to make them viable in space or on other celestial bodies. There are three principal obstacles to be overcome in adapting a terrestrial creature to life in space. It must learn to live and be happy in zero G, zero T, and zero P, that is to say, zero gravity, zero temperature, and zero pressure. Of these, zero G is probably the easiest to cope with, although we are still quite ignorant of the nature of the physiological hazards which it imposes. To deal with zero T is simple in principle, although it may be awkward in practice. Fur and feathers provide even better insulation in a vacuum than they do in air or in water. The most important and the most difficult part of the adaptation of life to the cosmos is the adaptation to zero P. It is only by adapting to zero pressure, by learning to live in vacuum, that life can be liberated from narrow and malodorous confinement in space capsules and spacesuits. The move of life from air to vacuum is as fundamental and as liberating as the move which our ancestors made from water to air 500 million years ago. I cannot pretend to have understood the problems of adaptation in detail. I could not define the specifications for a zero-P potato precisely enough for a genetic engineer to sit down and begin working out the DNA sequences to put into its chromosomes. The best I can do is to quote from that old and frustrated engineer, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who already understood the essentials of the problem of zero-P life when he published his book, Dreams of Earth and Sky, in the Russian provincial town of Kaluga in 1895. The passage which I quote is a dialogue between Tsiolkovsky and the guide who is escorting him around the solar system. So I quote from Tsiolkovsky, 1895. "These remarkable creatures combine the characteristics of animals and plants, and so I call them animal plants. All right, don't get angry. Just explain how your creatures avoid getting dried up like mummies." "That is simple. Their skin is covered with a glassy layer, thin and flexible, but absolutely impermeable to gases and liquids and all kinds of particles, so that the creatures are protected from any loss of material. Their bodies have appendages which look like wings and are exposed to the sun, serving as chemical laboratories for the production of energy and food. Such appendages would be an encumbrance in the Earth's gravity field, but in the zero-g environment of space, they are hardly noticeable, even with a surface area of 7,000 square meters. Stop! How do your animal plants talk to each other and exchange ideas without any air? They have a much more perfect and natural means of communication. One part of their body carries under the transparent skin an area like a camera obscura on which moving pictures are constantly playing, following the flow of their thoughts and representing them precisely. The pictures are formed by fluids of various colors which flow through a web of fine channels under the skin." So I leave Tsiolkovsky at this point, dreaming of celestial creatures who communicate with each other in glorious Technicolor sign language. This dream of Tsiolkovsky is especially poignant because of the fact that Tsiolkovsky himself was cut off from easy communication with his terrestrial fellow creatures by his deafness. For a deaf man, sign language and television are natural channels of communication. Radio is not. Tsiolkovsky might have said of himself what the British Foreign Secretary George Canning said in 1826, when he had broken away from the alliance of reactionary governments in Europe and recognized the independence of the new Latin American republics. "I look to the Indies and I call in the New World to redress the balance of the old." Tsiolkovsky called into existence the new world of cosmic biology, toward which his invention of interplanetary rocketry was only a stepping stone, to redress the balance between living and non-living in the old world of natural cosmology, to redress the balance that was destroyed when Newton consigned his more speculative manuscripts to the attic. Newton banished life from the celestial spaces. Tsiolkovsky showed us the way to bring it back. Newton was a unifier, Tsiolkovsky a diversifier. If we are striving to reach a balanced view of the universe, we need to listen to them both. So for the remainder of this talk, I assume that life is able to solve the technical problems of adapting itself to zero G, zero T, and zero P. I assume that life is capable of making itself at home in every corner of the universe, just as it has made itself at home in every corner of this planet. I wish now to go beyond qualitative statements and try to begin a quantitative assessment of the potentialities of life in the universe. For a quantitative assessment, some degree of abstraction is required. In order to make quantitative statements which are independent of local accidents, we need to introduce an abstract description of living processes independent of mechanical and chemical details. My argument is based on a fundamental assumption concerning the nature of life, that life resides in organization rather than in substance. So I assume, in other words, that my consciousness is inherent in the way the molecules in my head are organized and not in the substance of the molecules themselves. So if this assumption is true, that life is organization rather than substance, then it makes sense to imagine life detached from flesh and blood and embodied in networks of superconducting circuitry or interstellar dust clouds. So let me state my assumptions in a precise fashion. I call the assumption that life can be described in the abstract the hypothesis of abstraction. The hypothesis of abstraction says that every living creature is characterized by a number Q, which is a measure of the complexity of the creature. Q is simply the quantity of entropy produced by the creature's metabolism during the time it takes to perform a simple action, such as moving when poked or yelling when hurt. When the quantity of entropy is expressed in bits of information, Q becomes a pure number. For a human being, Q turns out to be about 10 to the power 23, which is a rough measure of the amount of entropy we have to generate in order to say, cogito ergo sum. In addition to the hypothesis of abstraction, I make a much stronger assumption, which I call the hypothesis of adaptability. The hypothesis of adaptability says that given sufficient time, life can adapt itself to any environment whatever. This is certainly an exaggeration, but it's of interest to examine the idealized case of perfect adaptability. The formal statement of the hypothesis of adaptability is as follows. Suppose we have two environments, A and B, with a sufficient supply of matter and energy, but with different environmental conditions of temperature, pressure, chemistry, and so on. If a creature of complexity Q can exist in A, then an equivalent creature with the same complexity Q can exist in B. The word equivalent means that the creature in B has the same behavior patterns as the creature in A. If one is intelligent, the other is equally intelligent. If one is conscious, the other is also conscious. If one of them can talk to its friends about the contents of its consciousness, the other can describe in an equivalent language a subjectively identical consciousness. So these hypotheses of abstraction and adaptability have some similarity to the first and second laws of thermodynamics. They are simple statements of a qualitative nature, and yet they provide a foundation for a quantitative science of cosmic ecology. The main theorem of cosmic ecology is that for a life form of fixed complexity adapting itself to a variety of environments, the rate of metabolism of energy varies with the square of the temperature. This fact, that energy consumption goes like temperature squared, has important consequences. It means that cold environments are fundamentally more favorable to complex forms of life than hot environments. Life is, after all, an ordered form of matter, and low temperature favors order. In the long run, life depends less on an abundant supply of energy than on a good signal-to-noise ratio. The colder the environment, the quieter the background, the more thrifty life can be in its use of energy. How far life can go depends not only on biological adaptability, but also on physical cosmology. If the physical universe is finite in space and time, the possible scope of life is also finite. In this case, as John Wheeler graphically describes it, the universe, which begins its existence with a big bang, ends its existence with a big crunch. The big crunch is a universal collapse into heat death, with the sky growing hotter and hotter until it finally falls in on us and carries us into a space-time singularity at infinite temperature. Nothing alive can survive the big crunch. If our universe is finite, then life will barely have time to spread itself once around the cosmos before the inexorable collapse begins. If that is to be our fate, then life is as the poet Hausmann described it. Here on the level sand between the sea and land, what shall I build or write against the fall of night? Tell me of runes to grave that hold the bursting wave, or bastions to design for longer date than mine. If, on the other hand, we live in an open universe, infinite in space and time, and continuing to expand into a future without end, then life has to face a prospect of slow freezing rather than quick frying. The universe grows constantly colder as it expands, and the supply of free energy is constantly dwindling. To many people, this future of endless ice has seemed even more dismal than the future of cataclysmic fire. But the laws of cosmic ecology put these futures into a very different perspective. If the hypothesis of adaptability is correct, life has a clear preference for ice over fire. In an expanding universe, life can adapt itself as the eons go by, constantly matching its metabolism of energy to the falling temperature of its surroundings. Since we are assuming perfect adaptability, the rate of energy metabolism falls with the square of the temperature. This has the consequence that in an expanding universe, life of any fixed degree of complexity can survive forever upon a finite store of energy. The pulse of life will beat more slowly as the temperature falls, but will never stop. The discoveries of recent decades in particle physics have led us to place great emphasis. The universe is completely symmetrical and featureless. As it cools to lower and lower temperatures, it breaks one symmetry after another, allowing more and more diversity of structure to come into existence. The phenomenon of life also fits naturally into this picture. Life, too, is a symmetry breaking. In the beginning, a homogeneous ocean somehow differentiated itself into cells and animalcules, predators and prey. Later on, a homogeneous population of apes differentiated itself into languages and cultures, arts and sciences and religions. Every time that a symmetry is broken, new levels of diversity and creativity become possible. I believe it is in the nature of our universe and in the nature of life that this process of diversification will have no end. My theoretical physicist colleagues have recently found serious reasons to believe that all matter may be unstable. According to their latest theoretical models, the grand unified models of particle physics, the nuclei of all atoms will disappear into positrons and photons and neutrinos with a lifetime of the order of 10 to the power 33 years. The reality of this universal decay of matter into radiation is now to be put to experimental test. Within a few years, we should know for sure whether matter is permanent or transient. If the experiment decides that matter is transient, then life will have to face some severe problems about 10 to the power 33 years from now. 10 to the 33 years may seem to us like a long time, but in the eye of eternity, it is but an instant. If the universe is open, the history of life will be only just beginning when the disappearance of matter threatens its existence. This will be the supreme test of life's adaptability. I do not know whether we can survive without protons, but I do not see any reason even then to declare the situation hopeless. If the assumptions of abstraction and adaptability are correct, the patterns of life and consciousness should be transferable without loss from one medium to another. After the protons are gone, we shall still have electrons and positrons and photons, and immaterial plasma may do as well as flesh and blood as a vehicle for the patterns of our thoughts. Perhaps the best possible universe is a universe of constant challenges, a universe in which survival is barely possible but not too easy. If optimism is the philosophy of people who welcome challenges, then we have plenty of reason to be optimists. One of the great scientists of this century was the crystallographer Desmond Bernal, who began looking at the crystal structure of nucleic acids with X-rays long before DNA became fashionable. Bernal was also a gifted writer and philosopher. In the year 1929, he wrote a little book, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, an inquiry into the three enemies of the rational soul. He explored with extraordinary vision and boldness the possible future of mankind and the ways in which we may defeat the three traditional enemies of our progress: the world, symbolizing material obstacles, famine and flood and poverty; the flesh, symbolizing our bodily infirmities, disease and senility and death; the devil, symbolizing the dark irrational forces within our own minds, greed and fear and jealousy and madness. His vision went very far into the future, and at the end he described what he saw as the ultimate transformation of life in the universe. He anticipated some of the discoveries which biologists and physicists were to make 50 years later. In particular, he foresaw and welcomed the transition of life from material substance into ethereality, which, if the grand unified models are right, the decay of protons will make inevitable. So now I quote from Bernal's book from the year 1929. One may picture then these beings, nuclearly resident, so to speak, in a relatively small set of mental units, each utilizing the bare minimum of energy, connected together by a complex of ethereal intercommunication, and spreading themselves over immense areas and periods of time by means of inert sense organs, which, like the field of their active operations, would be in general at a great distance from themselves. As the scene of life would be more the cold emptiness of space than the warm, dense atmospheres of the planets, the advantage of containing no organic material at all, so as to be independent of both of these conditions, would be increasingly felt. Bit by bit, the heritage in the direct line of mankind, the heritage of the original life emerging on the face of the earth, would dwindle, and in the end disappear effectively, being preserved perhaps as some curious relic, while the new life, which conserves none of the substance and all the spirit of the old, would take its place and continue its development. Such a change would be as important as that in which life first appeared on the earth's surface, and might be as gradual and imperceptible. Finally, consciousness itself may end or vanish in a humanity that has become completely etherealized, losing the close-knit organism, becoming masses of atoms in space communicating by radiation, and ultimately perhaps resolving itself entirely into light. That may be an end or a beginning, but from here it is out of sight. So that's Bernal writing in 1929. From here it is out of sight. Or if you find Bernal's description too optimistic for our present mood of doom and gloom, there is the more sardonic but equally bold statement of the biologist J.B.S. Haldane. Haldane was one of the angry young men who fought in the trenches in World War I and came out of that inferno with a bitter laugh. Writing in 1924, 5 years before Bernal, he summarized his view of the human situation in a little book called Daedalus, or The Future of Science. Here is Haldane's verdict on the prospects of life in the universe. The human intellect is feeble, and there are times when it does not assert the infinity of its claims. But even then, though in black jest it bows and nods, I know it is roaring at the gods, waiting the last eclipse. Thank you.
Professor Eric Vogt will take our speaker to Lecture Hall 6 so the other audience can see him and ask him a question or two. If the rest of you could wait, Professor Dyson will be back in a few minutes.
And you'll hear the questions here.
Oh, yeah, and you will hear the questions and the answers here. I hope.
We'll have the first question or two from the audience here. Could you please speak out clearly, and we'll repeat the question for the audience in the other room. Who wants to start? Yes, Tony Arrett.
I was surprised for you to find that 1895 quote.
Repeat the question.
How surprised was I to find this 1895 quote? Very surprised. In fact, I don't remember when I found that. But it was Shklovsky who told me about it, the Russian astronomer, because he's been reading Tsiolkovsky since he was a schoolboy. That's what the Russians are brought up on.
Next, over here.
Well, that's...
Repeat the question.
Why is it...
Why a Q of 10 to the 23rd?
Why is Q 10 to the 23rd? That is, roughly speaking, the number of active molecules in a human body, more or less. And it's a rather technical question to see what that means in terms of the number of operations that a creature has to go through in order to do something. Roughly speaking, each molecule turns over once, and so the Q is approximately equal to the number of molecules. But I wouldn't say that's a very satisfactory answer.
Yes. You?
When you want to consider seriously the possibility of life possibly in our present universe on a scale very different from the molecular scale.
Repeat the question.
Am I prepared to consider the possibility of life in our universe, but on a very different scale from the molecular scale? The answer is clearly yes. When these, I mean, if what I'm saying makes any sense at all, as one expands to lower and lower temperatures, as life adapts itself to lower and lower temperatures, the linear scale of things has to get bigger. As the temperature goes down and energies become less, we have to extend ourselves over bigger and actually bigger and bigger volumes of space, so that we are certainly moving out of the domain of molecular sizes.
Yes, maybe one final quick question, then we'll go to the other room. Back there.
This is your basic What was the last couple of words?
That's not concept.
God concept.
Of a God concept, yes. So the question is my conception of the nature of life as organization. Now, what exactly was the question again?
just an elucidation of a God concept.
Is it?
Yes.
Yes, that is a much clearer question. Is my basic proposition just that life
is organization?
The trouble is, I'm so busy thinking to how to answer it that I don't remember the text of the question. But I think the answer is yes, and so that was a simple one. But in its first form, I found it hard to make up my mind.
Thank you. We'll take him now back to the other room, but thank you. We'll have time for one question here. Who wants to start? Yes, here.
Could you tell me, give us the DNA of the caterpillar, because there's been the blueprint for a butterfly later, the idea of a metamorphosis. What do you think the possibility of a metamorphosis for human beings is? I know that part of the DNA code is masked by the histones, and if they get rid of that, maybe there's something in there that would imply a metamorphosis to the human race. I guess this would imply a panspermia, that we came from somewhere.
So the question is, I might as well restate the question if I can remember it. Yes, I mean, so the question is, why don't you do that while I'm trying to think of the answer? I find it awfully hard to repeat the question while I'm thinking.
Come up here and state your question clearly so everybody can hear it.
Yes. Okay, what I'm wondering about is, even as the metamorphosis of a caterpillar, the blueprint for the butterfly is contained in the caterpillar, I'm wondering if this is a possibility with human beings. For example, part of the DNA code is still masked by histones, and once they get rid of this, is there a possibility that we could just be on the verge of a mutation going into outer space and would be like butterflies, changing from the caterpillar stage?
Thank you very much. Yes, that makes it much easier to answer. No, it's a very poetic thought. I wish it were true, but I can't believe it, actually. I think we have to work a lot harder before we become butterflies. It's not something that's just handed to us on a plate. But, of course, we don't know. We have, there are, of course, cases in the biological world where creatures have become juvenile, that is to say, where later stages of their development have been lost, and where they have evolved into juvenile stages, and where presumably the adult stages are there covered up in the genome. So it's not outside the bounds of possibility that something like that might be true of us. I think it's highly improbable. Anyway, I'm not a biologist, so I shouldn't speculate further. It's an interesting thought, and I wish it were true.
One quick question from Tony Thomas.
Just a few years ago, you had very definite plans for how inorganic life at a little above absolute zero would behave. Do you really so strongly believe in proton decay now that you've abandoned all of those plans for how life might evolve?
So the answer is, I don't believe in proton decay. I think it's a question that has to be settled by experiment, and will be settled by experiment. But we certainly we have some fairly sound reasons for taking it seriously, anyhow, as a very serious possibility. And in some ways, of course, it makes life more interesting. It's a new challenge. It's certainly the most severe challenge that life has ever had to confront. If we can get over that one, then we'll really be in good shape.
Thank you.
We shall simply follow the same procedure here. If you will raise your hand, and I'll ask Professor Dyson to repeat the question again for the sake of the people in the other rooms.
I'd be really interested to know if we're going to be going out into space and actually looking for life, in particular intelligent life in the universe, how we're going to recognize it. You know, I mean, we could pass it right by. Do we go up with it, go up to the machine and measure its feedback?
So the question is, how do we recognize intelligent life in the universe when we see it? And this is, of course, not a simple question. There are many different answers to it. And roughly speaking, the easy way is to look for radio signals. If one sees radio signals with an artificial pattern, then it's very, very strong evidence that whatever produced them is intelligent. There are patterns in the signals that we produce which it's very hard to imagine arising from natural sources. That's not true, of course, of other kinds of astronomical signals that we see. If we look for intelligent creatures in other channels, then we'll have greater difficulty in identifying them. And the general rule is that one should just look in as many different ways as possible, and one won't be sure. One will only gradually come to suspect something of being intelligent, and one will have to accumulate evidence in all kinds of different channels before one can hope to be sure.
Could you enlarge on the use of the word information? At the very beginning of your talk, you said once information gets involved, it can be better.
So I'm asked to enlarge on the use of the word information in the beginning when I quoted the central dogma of molecular biology, that once information gets into protein, it can't get out. Well, that has a technical meaning. The point is that DNA is able to tell protein how to arrange itself. That's what one means by saying the information gets from the DNA into the protein, that the DNA is a blueprint for constructing the protein. And what the central dogma says is that you can't make a blueprint out of proteins for constructing DNA.
If you speak of the open universe, do you disagree with Einstein that the universe is finite?
The question is, when I speak of an open universe, do I disagree with Einstein saying that the universe is finite? The answer is yes. I mean, of course, Einstein wasn't dogmatic about that. He only proposed a simple model of a finite universe. He didn't believe in it as necessarily being the universe. In fact, it was clear as soon as one discovered the recession of the faraway galaxies that this Einstein universe wasn't the one we live in. So Einstein, I think, was quite resigned to the fact that very likely the universe is open. It's just a historical fact that he, in fact, proposed a closed universe first. The question is whether the notion of an open universe is connected with the astronomical idea of a steady-state universe. The answer is no. In fact, the steady-state universe is one very special type of open universe, but the kind that is most popular these days among the astronomers is not steady-state. It's in fact an evolving universe, and we have very strong evidence that that's the one we're living in.
Is the idea of an expanding universe based entirely on the red shift? And because there seems to be some question as to whether the red shift is due to an aberration of the rays during the interval, or whether it's actually due to the fact that the object is receding.
So the question is whether one really feels confident that the redshifts that one observes astronomically are evidence for an expanding universe. This is a big and complicated subject, and I mean, I can answer it very simply by saying yes, that in my opinion, I think the evidence is overwhelmingly strong that the redshifts are a real expansion. It's possible to hold the other view, as some people do, but I think you have really to tie yourself in knots in order to hold it. So the question is whether cybernetic intelligence may be the wave of the future, since it's much more suited to living in zero temperature, zero pressure, and zero gravity. And the answer is yes, I do think of that as being one possibility. And I don't quite know what cybernetic intelligence is, but I suppose it's anything that's not made of flesh and blood, more or less. Yes, and silicon-based, for example. And I think that certainly is very much in my mind. I wanted to keep the discussion general and not tie it down to any particular manifestation. But clearly, our imaginations are not strong enough to imagine anything that we haven't yet seen. It's almost invariably true that when something new is discovered astronomically, that it has never been imagined before it's discovered. So we should never think that we're capable of imagining things that will be discovered in 10 years' time.
You once wrote a description of the developmental future stages of humanity, from the planetary to the intergalactic,
so the question is whether I still think of humanity as expanding from a planetary phase to a galactic phase and a universal phase, which this is not my idea, by the way. That was the first point of view that was propounded by the Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev, who first publicized this, and he first thought of it and published speculations of this kind. And I think it's very reasonable. It is in fact not at all a foregone conclusion that we are the ones who are going to carry the banner of intelligence through the cosmos. Maybe somebody else will do it, but I feel fairly confident that somebody will.
Perhaps two more questions.
So, I don't know who gets it.
explain their ideas about the Q number?
Yes, the question is, can I explain my ideas about the Q number? Well, it's simply a measure of the complexity of a situation, and I mean, not begging the question as to whether the situation is alive. It's simply a physical measure of the degree of complication of a situation, and therefore, it in some sense it describes how much information that the system can contain, or how much complexity it carries. But I mean, to define it precisely, of course, you need a blackboard and a piece of chalk.
Two hands went up simultaneously. We'll have a gentleman here and a gentleman there. First here.
Though we may carry our intelligence out of the universe, what are your feelings about intelligence on this planet? Are we the most intelligent?
Question is, though we may carry intelligence out into the universe, are we in fact the most intelligent creatures on this planet? And the answer is, of course, it all depends what you mean by intelligence. And I think the easy way out of that question is to say we'll talk about technology, not about intelligence. And so that we are certainly the technological species on this planet. Whether we are also the intelligent species, of course, is subject to debate. And the question is whether I think we should go out of our own solar system before we reach any life. The answer, of course, is wait and see. But no, I mean, as for myself, I would not be altogether surprised if we found life within the solar system. But I think it's certainly much, I would say, in my view, more likely that we won't. I mean, the conditions under which life will have to exist if it's in the solar system are very different to the conditions that we're familiar with. It could happen. For example, Jupiter is a good place. I mean, Jupiter is a huge, big planet. The surface is quite cold. If you go 100 miles down or so into the lower atmosphere of Jupiter, you find regions where there certainly is liquid water and temperatures of a kind that living creatures would enjoy. You don't have any solid ground to stand on, and the question is, does that mean that it's impossible? We simply don't know. I mean, that's one possible place where life could be flourishing within the solar system. There are many others. We just haven't yet looked very hard. We haven't looked at all in many places. So the question is certainly open. On the other hand, I would myself say that if I had to bet on it, I wouldn't bet very big odds.
Thank you. Professor Eric Volt, a unifier, a diversifier, and a professor of physics, will thank our speaker.
Well, let me thank you for listening first.
On this foggy fall night in Vancouver, there are clearly 1,000 or more people who are very, very grateful for Freeman Dyson coming out and speaking to us today. This institute has been devoted for 60 years to high ideas on a Saturday night, to good use of language, and to value the spoken word. Many of us here have known Freeman for a long time. There are many of his friends in the audience. Many have followed his writings. Many have admired his very elegant mathematics and his profound ideas, and also his willingness in science to be romantic. I think overall people have valued him perhaps more for anything above all else for the sheer joy of his ideas. I think, and we saw that today, joy in the face of the almost inevitable decay of the universe a million, billion, billion years from now. joy as we were going through the corridors and he was struggling uphill against the forces of disorganization. Well, for that joy and for the ideas that he brought to us today and for the elegant way in which he expressed them to us, all of us really owe him a great deal of thanks. Thank you, Freeman.
Next week, Connor Cruz O'Brien.